Next, we'll have Dr. Stephen Chang talk about costs and sort of some of the deliverables of treatment. And I encourage you to stay for the session after that, which we're going to discuss some cases, some real sort of practical cases where it involves real general surgery patients that came to us with renal masses, and sort of hopefully we'll brainstorm together about management of these sometimes challenging patients.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Drs. Kudakov and Tan for the invitation to present today. We'll be switching gears a little bit, talking about cost implications for renal mass management choices. I have no disclosures. So in terms of medical advancement, in really any field, I feel like we've gotten more and more options. There's really a multitude of options for almost every medical condition I can think of. And with more options comes more decisions. In terms of what we have for renal masses, particularly small renal masses, we have a multitude of different options, as has been alluded to by my colleagues. And it's always a balance. You've seen sort of this picture of a scale several times today already. So on one side, you know, quality and quantity of life, optimizing that. On the opposite side, the potential trauma of therapy. And I would add to that, medical expenditures. Now, why is it important to consider cost? These are the types of graphs that I'm sure everyone in the audience has seen in terms of the inflating cost of medical expenditures in the United States. There is really no area of the federal budget that outpaces major health care programs. And of course, with the U.S. Doing this much in terms of spending, the idea of value is really at the forefront in terms of the media and experts, in terms of our economists, to see what are we getting back for all this money that we're spending in the care of our patients. And in terms of how much of a burden, financial burden, there is for kidney cancer, it's actually not very clear. In this one paper in 2007, funded by the Urologic Disease in America Project, this group by Dr. Eric Wallen, who is colleagues with a couple of my colleagues over here, showed that in 2000, there's a budget about, or there's the burden of disease of about $400 million. In the same year, using some similar data sets, it was $5.19 billion. So you can see it's kind of all over the place. But I think clearly there's a huge burden of this disease on the healthcare system, being one of the top 10 cancers in the United States, even though it's perhaps somewhat difficult to know exactly how much it is. So where does this burden of disease come from, or the economic burden of disease? We have a multitude of diagnostic tests that lead to identification of renal masses. We have interventions, whether it be percutaneous ablation or extirpative surgeries, which can be expensive, and then a multitude of post-treatment surveillance imaging. So this is a pretty standard algorithm or management workflow. And if you were to map out costs and health outcome or effectiveness, if you have some, say in the middle, your standard of care, your status quo, your reference strategy, and compared to that, if something costs, for example, less money and improved outcomes, well, that's a winner because it saves money and, you know, patients do better. On the opposite end of the spectrum, something costs more money and unfortunately their health suffers in the process, well, you really want to avoid that option. Now, in reality, most of the time, we're not really looking at these two quadrants, the top left and the bottom right. It's really, perhaps something saves money, it's not quite as good, or something is pretty expensive, and it's better, but wow, is it really worth that cost? And that's where the questions are. And the formal type of analysis is a cost-effectiveness analysis. Often, the reference standard is if it costs less than $50,000 per quality-adjusted life years gained, then it is a well-received treatment alternative. It's pretty economically efficient. So in the effort to apply this type of analysis to the issue that we have here, small renal masses, I went ahead and did that very thing. We looked at a multitude of different treatment options for our base case model, a healthy 65-year-old individual, asymptomatic, unilateral small renal mass, looking at four different immediate strategies of open partial lap ablation, percutaneous ablation, the same ones after a period, potentially after a period of active surveillance, and in a non-surgical strategy just to observe these patients. We created a Markov model to calculate all those costs and the health benefits. And I won't bore you with all the details, but just to point out that we did create a time horizon, a lifetime time horizon. So basically, we're calculating everything from the point that they're diagnosed until they die. And this is a societal perspective, so it's not just the direct costs of being in the hospital, but all the, also perhaps lost revenue from being in the hospital or treatments or follow-up visits. That's all going to have additional costs beyond the direct hospital costs. And again, we used a willingness to pay threshold of $50,000 per quality adjusted life year. So if you can recall what I had mentioned before on that little graph on the cost versus effectiveness, in the bottom left is observation. This turned out to be the least costly, but even least costly for lifetime costs from the point of diagnosis until they died was over $80,000. And these patients achieved nearly 9 quality adjusted life years gain. That would be 9 perfect years of life, 8.91 actually. And the next best option was surveillance, followed potentially by percutaneous ablation. This is about $95,000 and 9.32 quality adjusted life years gained. And the ICER, or what's called the incremental cost effectiveness ratio, was $33,000. So that's less than that $50,000 cutoff point. So economically, it makes sense to move from observation to surveillance plus or minus percutaneous ablation. But yet we have a third option, which actually turns out to be even better, which is immediate laparoscopic partial nephrectomy. So it's about $115,000, 9.82 quality adjusted life years. And again, going by that ICER, the incremental cost effectiveness ratio, it's about $36,000. So it makes sense. It's less than $50,000. It makes sense to move it up. So you're gaining enough health. You're getting enough bang for your buck out of this more expensive procedure for it to be a reasonable option. And what we found is that active surveillance, really, it really decreased costs and decreased quality of adjusted life years gained. So open and lap partial compared to their counterparts in surveillance, lap ablation versus surveillance, followed by possible lap ablation, and then perc ablation followed by possible surveillance followed by possible perc ablation. Everything's cheaper, but you also don't gain as much in terms of quality of adjusted life years gained. So the impact of active surveillance was that it did minimize unnecessary treatment of benign small renal masses to some extent. But there was a slightly increased risk of chronic kidney disease. We modeled it so that some of these patients, unfortunately, would have to have a radical nephrectomy instead of a partial nephrectomy or ablative procedure. And then even though the risk overall was very small for metastatic disease, there was a slightly higher risk for those patients who were on the active surveillance cohorts. But things have changed a little bit. If you look at this this publication, you know, right now, robotic partial nephrectomy outpaces everything else in terms of the type of surgical procedure that we do for small renal masses. 2/3 of cases are being performed in this fashion. And as I'm sure all you are aware, there's a huge criticism for robotics is how much it costs. So how does that change our scenario here? So we, over the past year or so, have updated our this model. We've taken out lap partial and replaced that with robotic partial. And overall, it seems like the use of lap ablation is pretty minimal, so that's been removed from the model itself. So we're comparing these options at this point. We also changed many of the key inputs from using data from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services reimbursement data to a hospital discharge database called Premier, which has actual hospital reported costs. So we're hopefully getting more accurate cost numbers. And similarly, instead of using data solely from the published literature, which could be biased because they can be from high volume experts who may have a different outcome than your general community urologists, we're using this large database, which is much more reflective of the general medical environment. So also, we've included information about chronic kidney disease that came out since that initial study that there are studies that show, randomized studies that show there's really no difference between radical and partial nephrectomy in terms of outcome, but further analysis of larger data sets have sort of broken down things into surgical and medical chronic kidney disease. And then, so thus we're applying the consequences of chronic kidney disease only to those patients who are less healthy and really maintaining good health and really no consequence of chronic kidney disease among those healthier patients. So just to cut to the chase, in terms of our updated model, if you have our base case scenario with our 65 healthy individual, open partial nephrectomy becomes the most cost-effective option. And this is perhaps not surprising, because robotic partial nephrectomy was consistently $1,400 to $1,800 more expensive. And that range is due to some issues with complications. We did break things up by surgical volume and the health of our patients. But interestingly enough, when we did break things up, our unhealthy patient among our highest volume surgeons, that sort of subset of patients really did best with a robotic partial nephrectomy. And that really was because the highest volume surgeons were the ones who had the lowest complication rates. And in fact, this type of patient who's not healthy would in fact do significantly or appreciably worse among lower volume surgeons. So it is important to note that the volume of your surgeon, much like Dr. Masters mentioned about the expertise of our interventional radiologists, it really does make a difference as well among surgeons. And if you look at the cost breakdown, what really stands out here is the area in gray, which turns out to be the post-treatment surveillance costs. And just an enormous amount of cost. It ranges from about 70% for the percutaneous ablation to about 75, 77% for partial nephrectomy. In fact, if you look at metastatic disease, this actually is a considerable cost when you look at the entire cohort, because it is, despite the fact that it is a very rare complication, or very rare outcome rather, it is so much more expensive than anything else we have that it has a disproportionate impact on the overall average cost of these large cohorts. And you can see the actual intervention itself is really kind of a fraction of the total cost of care. Again, we're looking at lifetime costs. And so part of that big, large gray area is that last year of life, which is an extraordinarily expensive year. But still, when you whittle it down to just surveillance imaging and blood tests, that really does represent the bulk of the cost for our patients. But then again, one of the other phenomena, which I don't know is really well documented in literature, is though I think some of my colleagues to my left would agree that I think practice has changed somewhat, and potentially due to robotics. If you have a tumor like you see on the left, really any approach could be very successful. And back when I did a lot of lap partial nephrectomies, this is the type of tumor that I would approach in that fashion. If it was larger, I'd do an open partial. But now, even with the large tumors, I feel very comfortable doing a robotic partial nephrectomy. And I haven't actually done an open procedure in a number of years for a small renal mass. So this led to the idea of perhaps stepping back. Instead of looking at individual tumors, what about sort of hospitals with and without a robot? If you have a hospital without a robot versus one with, it turns out that is a distinctly different breakdown in whether or not those patients receive a partial versus radical nephrectomy. In fact, about 60% more patients are getting a partial nephrectomy of some variety in a hospital with robotic that offers robotic partial nephrectomy. Now, they're not necessarily all robotically performed, but it does seem to be a distinct difference between those hospitals with and without partial or robotics. So when we looked at this, instead of looking at each individual treatment options, we looked at hospitals with and without robotics. And here we can see that the hospitals with robotic partial nephrectomy on your top right, that is more expensive, but it also achieves better outcomes in terms of health outcomes. And again, that incremental cost effectiveness ratio, we want to keep that less than $50,000. Here it was just a little bit over $5,000. So while this is not a definitive study in that regard, it does suggest that having robotics has shifted the way that we've done these treatments. And as much as one could say that radical and partial nephrectomy are pretty much the same for our healthy patient, it turns out for incidental renal masses, we don't usually find them in healthy patients. We find them in unhealthy patients. So that's why there's still a very strong push in the field of urology to preserve as many kidneys as possible, because there are some consequences in those who are unhealthy. For this study, we did a whole series of sensitivity analyses, and absolutely no scenario could we find that our answer was different. It was always robotic. The hospitals with robotics just tended to do better. So in conclusion, in terms of the management of renal masses, it does impose a significant burden on the healthcare system. At a minimum, it's probably at least $80,000, $80,000 to $120,000 in terms of lifetime costs. And it does appear that there are benefits to intervention improves quality and quantity of life. Overall, these analyses should be looking at what reduces the overall burden of this disease on the healthcare system. Surveillance costs, this is really the big takeaway. The interventions is one thing, but really all the costs that follow it really imposes the biggest part of that economic burden. So if we need to pick one area to focus on to cut down on costs, I would think that it would be focused on this part. If we can develop, say, a simple biomarker instead of having someone get a CT scan or MRI, that may dramatically change the cost equation here. And finally, robotic surgery, as expensive as it seems to be across the board, it isn't that big a part of this total cost. And in fact, in many cases, because it is shifting patients away from radical and towards partial nephrectomy, it actually represents a possible reason why we might be able to reduce the burden of this disease on the healthcare system. So thank you very much for your attention.
All right, we have a few cases just to run through, and hopefully we'll stimulate a good conversation, and we will try to make our way through it in a timely fashion to leave some time for questions at the end. So the first case is case one, 72-year-old male with a history of hematuria and BPH in Lutz. He underwent a cystoscopy which showed a small bladder tumor and underwent a TURB-TURBT followed by a CT urogram, and on the CT urogram there was an incidental right renal mass. He also noted a 10-pound weight loss, and his performance status was ECOG-1. Has a history of hypertension, umbilical hernia with mesh, which was about a 6 by 6 centimeter piece. He's mildly obese with BMI 32, overall pretty good kidney function. And then these are his scans, and you can see here there is a mass that's posterior. It's like about 4 centimeters in size. Nephrometry score, another one of Dr. Kudikoff's achievements. It's a scale of classifying the complexity of the kidney tumor, and this is about an intermediate complex tumor. You can see it again here, again posterior near the hilum and collecting system. So for the panel members here, what options would you offer, and would you consider a renal mass biopsy? Maybe Raj, you want to start?
Yeah, great case. He's not old, but he's not young either. He has a relative paucity of comorbid diseases, but I would ask him what his goals are and what his treatment preferences are first before even going over options. Because if he said, well, I'm not really sure about what I want, what if this is not really going to pose a threat to me, then I would offer him a renal mass biopsy at the very beginning.
So that's actually very insightful. He actually was hesitant to consider treatment, and that did push the decision in one way. I guess, Stephen, what would you say?
I would echo many of the things that Dr. Masters mentioned. The specific options I would talk to him about would be active surveillance, percutaneous ablation, and a partial nephrectomy of some variety. What dictates my recommendation for renal mass biopsy is that I think it's going to change management. There are many patients who come in here with a relative who had breast cancer, and they saw, I'm like, this is different than breast cancer. And they're like, oh no, we got to do this because of my mom's history of breast cancer or something like that. So it's hard to alter one's thinking, and so you really have to have that discussion to see where the mentality is.
Alex, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of walk them through that. The best evidence for active surveillance is really masses less than 3 centimeters. 3 and 4 is a little bit of a gray zone. He's on the larger size for active surveillance. His, it sounds like he's not overly comorbid. The conversation is, are we gonna, if we do a biopsy, and this is really what I try to kind of pin the patient on, is if we do a biopsy and this is a benign mass where it comes back as oncocytoma, are we gonna watch it and we're not gonna do anything? And majority of patients, at least in my experience in their 70s, they're very comfortable watching that. Yeah. And so biopsy is terrific and ruling in oncocytomas, there's sort of this kind of uncertainty that hangs over about these hybrid malignancies where the oncocytomas can coexist with chromophobes. I mean, we looked at our data set. Basically, if it's a solitary mass like this, the chance of that is less than 5%. And really, I mean, we have a case report of a hybrid tumor that's, you know, high grade, but that's incredibly rare. I think biopsy has a lot to, you know, deliver here. So I generally, my, you know, septuagenarians, octogenarians, before moving forward with treatment, I would do a biopsy. But as far as treatment, I mean, these hilar masses, I think, lend themselves very poorly to ablation. There's just a heat sink from the hilum, so you're not going to ablate. So you might as well not treat it at all. And this is I do a lot of retroperitoneoscopic robotic partials. This is a great case for that. This,
yeah.
You know, I look at a tumor like that when it walks in, I get excited because I like
cases. It is amenable to, it is a nice one for a retro. So he, after having
can I also
the,
mention yeah. to the audience that a practical tip is to make sure you write on your request form to get core biopsies because, and I don't know whether other members of the panel would agree, but many times your ability to get diagnostic accuracy is highly improved when you get cores over FNAs.
I think that's a great point. I think, I don't know if Dr. Smaldone mentioned it, but when he was reporting the biopsy result data, it's specifically for core biopsies, not for FNA. And, you know, I think at least at my institution, they automatically do core biopsy, but that's not the case, you know, across the state of North Carolina. So that's a good take on point.
I mean, there's a little bit of a debate out there whether to do FNAs just to make sure that you have good needle placement. So our guys sometimes will do FNA as, you know, to make sure that the core biopsy is placed correctly. But you absolutely need to core all the data, of course.
Can I ask one question? In terms of, let's just say you do a biopsy, it comes back as an oncocytoma, and you mentioned follow. What do you mean exactly by follow? Do you repeat image, or do you just expect management and just wait for symptoms? That's where I have a hard time with renal mass biopsies. If it comes back as benign, whether it be an oncocytoma and you think it's 5% risk or less of a hybrid tumor, or it's a meningococcal adenoma, can you just say no more?
I mean, I think it's easier in a 70-year-old. I mean, if this biopsy comes back on oncocytoma, ultrasound in a year. And, you know, I mean, I'm very lazy to figure out.
I agree. In terms of what you said about cost, I was very impressed by that, and I use that information. If that patient had an oncocytoma, no more cross-sectional imaging. They go to a more cost-effective modality like ultrasound.
Yeah, I typically do just ultrasound.
Yeah. So he underwent, he elected to undergo a renal mass biopsy, and we did a chest CT to complete his staging. And then, incidentally, he had bilateral PEs and a esophageal mass. He underwent a endoscopy, which showed the esophageal mass, which you see here in the picture. And based on the ultrasound that was done, it was a clinical stage T1 and 0 disease. He had a negative PET CT as well. The biopsy core came back and showed clear cell renal cell carcinoma, nuclear grade 2 out of 4. So in this situation, what would your recommendation be in terms of management of his tumors? Now he has two primaries, presumably. Raj.
I think we must have teed each other up talking about esophageal cancer earlier. We didn't mean to. I think that, again, as a physician, to figure out what the force of the mortality of the pathology is. So if the force of mortality for his esophageal cancer is higher, that requires treatment first. I don't know anything about esophageal cancer, but I would suspect that's a more life-threatening problem. So I would have his esophageal cancer treated first, especially if he needs some kidney function for his systemic therapy treatment.
Steve and Alex, anything different on that, or?
I totally agree. I think that the renal mass, unless something is odd, is definitely low urgency. And I would certainly put it on the back burner. I wouldn't do something concurrent. I don't want to complicate what I presume to be a complex surgery for the esophageal or treatment for the esophageal malignancy. So I would definitely push the management of the kidney mass back.
Yeah, I mean, just about any predictive model will tell you that his chance of, and just, you know, which you showed us, chance of kidney cancer specific mortality in the next 5 years is less than 5%.
Yeah.
So esophageal cancer, I think, far out trumps this. Yeah.
So he underwent a unsuccessful endoscopic ablation of his esophageal tumor, and then he ultimately proceeded to a transthoracic esophagectomy. Final pathology showed a T1B, negative margins. He was seen in follow-up 3 months after surgery. He had a 40-pound weight loss, which, you know, sort of is, you know, at that point, sort of, you know, is this cancer or is it more likely the byproduct of his surgery? He also continued to be on anticoagulation for his PEs. We did repeat staging, show no evidence of metastatic disease and a stable renal mass. And I think just for the interest of time, we'll continue to proceed, but he's on surveillance, but likely will undergo a partial nephrectomy in a few months. The next case is a 70-year-old, actually female.
So what's a litmus test do you give? To give him to recur from esophageal cancer before you, you know, I mean, that's always a question in my mind is how before you take this person who may actually succumb to his primary malignancy, you know, why compromise his, you know, quality of life now to put him through an operation that probably may never, you know, sort of impact his or life expectancy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, in talking to his thoracic surgeon, you know, based on his stage and then the results of the surgery, they estimated that his 5-year survival from his esophageal is actually very high. And so in that situation, I sort of then sort of reset the clock and think of it more as this is now a guy with primary renal cell cancer, you know, decent complexity there as well. And it's definitely on the borderlines, you know, just above 4 centimeters. So I think there's a little bit of more concern there. I think the point's
I think, but that communication between specialties is very important. And what Rosh said, I think it goes both ways. I think for us to really make sure that when, you know, we can have some assumptions about a certain disease process, and it's important to talk to the primary care provider. And I think points of frustrations, you know, just like in case in your, you know, that you showed us that I think sometimes people assume certain mortality drivers from the disease that we take care of and never speak to us. And I think that could be sort of result in poor patient care.
One other point on that is the 40-pound weight loss and the fact that he's on anticoagulation. He's not a great candidate for a kidney partial nephrectomy, even though it's highly amenable to something like a robotic retroperitoneal prostatectomy, which is minimally invasive surgery. It's still major surgery.
Yeah.
So I would argue for, you know, quote-unquote active surveillance just to wait until he's in a better surgical state. I think the healthier you are going to surgery, the healthier you're coming out. So I wouldn't rush to surgery at all for the kidney.
Yeah. Agreed.
So this case is a 70-year-old female with stage 3 uterine serous carcinoma. She is scheduled for a robotic hysterectomy. And just to give you some additional context, uterine serous carcinoma is actually relatively rare, but is associated with a high risk of cancer-specific mortality. Staging scan shows an incidental small renal mass of the left kidney. She is otherwise a very sick person, atrial fibrillation, COPD, diabetes, pulmonary hypertension. She has very significant pulmonary comorbidity, and she actually had a trach for a couple of years. She can't ambulate up a flight of stairs. She's short of breath every day, and she's morbidly obese with a BMI of 56. Pulmonary and cardiology cleared her, but consider her intermediate to high risk. Normal kidney function as well. And you can see here, this is about a 4-centimeter mass, upper pole, left kidney, but overall low complexity. And just to kind of give you some additional information, when talking to the gynecology team who sent the referral in, the additional chemotherapy agents are not dependent on kidney function, so that is less of a consideration. So what options would you offer to the patient, and would the plans for an upcoming surgery for the uterine cancer influence your decision making or what you counsel the patient?
I'm feeling sorry for you having to actually deal with this case in clinic. It sounds like a real world clinic visit. So the first thing is she's going to have surgery for her uterine pathology, but I'm not going to let that influence what I'm going to do as someone who's managing her kidney mass, because I know, we all know, that increased operative time is directly associates with complications and mortality. So we want to get this very sick lady on and off the table. So doing some fancy thing with an XI robot and flipping around, putting another port in, doing something else is not what I personally would do. I would let her recover from whatever her gynecologic oncology surgeons are doing and then address her kidney mass. In terms of addressing her kidney mass, my options, again, would be surveillance, especially in someone with the amount of comorbidity she has. I was going to pull out my phone and use a calculator to figure out what her Charlson comorbidity index is, but I bet you it's 7. And she has a very poor 5-year survival rate, so I think observation is perfectly reasonable for her renal tumor. In terms of if she somehow was hell-bent to do a surgical approach, I would talk to her about the fact that you have an EGFR greater than 60, the operation associated with the least complications is a radical nephrectomy, and counsel her about that.
Stephen?
Again, I agree with all those statements. I would consider a biopsy just to make sure if she opted for a surgical procedure that we're doing it for the right reason. You'd hate to do all that and find out you have something that could have been avoided. Yeah. But yeah, I think that the idea of a radical nephrectomy, particularly like a lap radical nephrectomy, can be done relatively quickly on and off the table. That'd probably be my best, my preferred option for a relatively unhealthy woman like this.
Yeah, I mean, in my practice, if the number of centimeters in your renal mass exceeds the number of flights of stairs you can climb, I don't worry about your mass.
So she wanted to get surgery for a renal mass, and so she elected to do so. I think we already touched upon it in the conversation, but essentially she underwent a concurrent radical nephrectomy. Her pathology, she showed T1A, she had like a 3.9 centimeter negative margin, and then she had, it confirmed the pathology from her uterine cancer. Her hospital stay, she was discharged on day 7 because of pneumonia. She was readmitted, but subsequently discharged home and is recovering okay so far.
And the uterine pathology?
Yeah, it confirmed like the diagnosis that was there, but it was no evidence of positive lymph nodes or metastatic disease, so localized, confined to the uterus.
I asked because the typification or uterine carcinoma is surgical.
Yeah, I can't, I can't recall the details of that part. Sorry, but I think it was like it was stage 3 in the end in terms of the pathology, but I don't recall the exact pathology details of it. And we'll just make this the last case. This is a 56-year-old with an instantly discovered 6-centimeter right renal mass with imaging also of GI complaints. On the CT scan, there was colonic thickening and a possible mass. He was anemic at baseline with hemoglobin 7.1, but with normal kidney function, GFR greater than 60. Here's the CT scan. You see a large right renal mass, about 6 centimeters, nephrometry score of 9, again, in sort of the high intermediate range. And then you can see some thickening at the splenic flexure there, and then a colonoscopy shows a obstructing mass biopsy showing adenocarcinoma. So what would your potential plan B at this point, Raj?
Well, this seems to me, I'm not a general surgeon, but I would think that this is a really bad problem this person has with regard to a GI malignancy and needs all of the treatment that would be recommended for the GI malignancy. If it's a near obstructing mass, maybe they'll go right to surgery, although, again, I would defer that to my general surgery colleagues. In terms of concomitant or stage surgery, it is a larger renal mass, but I would probably still do it as a staged surgery. I don't feel that the recovery process for this patient is going to take that long. On the other hand, sometimes colon cancer operations don't go the way you like, and it's a prolonged recovery. So I don't want to necessarily add more morbidity to the patient. So in my mind, it'd be stage surgery. In terms of partial versus radical, I would attempt a partial. In terms of MIS versus open, I think somewhat if it depends on what the surgeons found when they got in over there. I have done MIS approaches after colectomy, especially this is a contralateral colectomy, so that wouldn't necessarily sway me one way or the other.
You know, in general, I usually don't like concomitant surgeries. I do everything I can to avoid that. I just feel like we're adding more risk unless there's a really compelling reason that something could not be done later. So I would favor not doing something at the same time. Partial versus radical, I feel like a radical would be very reasonable in this case. It could go either way, but I think I'd probably be leaning a little bit more towards radical nephrectomy. And frankly, if it's a radical, I'd definitely do it through a minimally invasive approach. I don't think there should be any issue with his surgery on the left side and the renal mass on the right side. So I would definitely do MIS if
they're doing the colon. Would you flip him?
Oh, if at
like
the same
if you
time,
do a concomitant.
If they're doing like an open colon, like say through a midline incision, then I probably just do it.
Right. If they're doing an open colon, does that change your mind?
Yeah.
What you're gonna do?
I mean, if they're gonna, it's all about minimizing morbidity afterwards. If they're already gonna have that morbidity,
they're gonna have a midline.
Yeah.
They're doing a big.
They're doing a midline,
I'd
just take out the kidney.
Yeah, I would just take it out that time.
But I wouldn't do a partial then. I'd take out the kidney.
Alex, anything to add?
Yeah, this is my case. I mean, that's what we did. I mean, it's actually the this is a fascinating case because look at the pathology here. So this is a really aggressive renal cell, 60% sarcomatoid. Hmm. They had a big midline. I just took the right kidney out. I was very glad I didn't do a partial. His driver of mortality is really, I mean, the colon mass looked very, very ugly, nearly obstructing. That's not going to be the driver of mortality, potentially, because nodes were negative. It was T3, but it was sort of moderately differentiated. The sarcomatoid renal cell is what's hanging over him.
In just the interest of time, we have about like 8 minutes left, so we'll open up to questions from anyone in the audience or anything. Yep.
My name is Jose Eduardo Robelo, surgical oncologist from Mexico. Congratulations for your pláticas, your talks. I think that these sessions must to encourage the approach with multidisciplinary specialties. In this case, for example, you present adenocarcinoma concurrent double primary synchronic. That's not very common. You know about that. So I don't see any colonoscopy previous to this management, so I don't know. We hear it, the audience. We have a more oncologist. The cancer is very special disease. I think, in my particular point of view, that this must encourage with the collaboration between urologists, urologists, oncologists, surgical oncologists, and GA surgeons. So another comment that I want to do is if you can please tell us about the Bosnia classification, what relation has with the incidental renal mass, I believe solid, but we have complex cystic masses too. That's one. Two, the age of the patient in the renal mass, it's important to consider a biopsy, and the third one, if you can tell us your experience in the absolute indications of renal biopsy, absolute indication.
So maybe I can take this one. So first, just to echo your comments, I think it's clearly, this panel shows that there's no right answer here a lot of the times. I mean, this is a conversation between, the specialties and really calibrating that risk balance and calibrating that decision. I mean, a lot of the times, these slides sort of don't show you the patient. I mean, the patient has certain preferences. They don't want to have two surgeries. They're okay doing having two surgeries. I mean, when you present the same information to different patients, you come to, to a different outcome. But for the Bosniak system, what you need to know is ones and twos don't even worry about. They're basically tumors. They're cysts that don't require any follow-up. They're basically, some 50% of patients at 50 years of age will have a cyst on their kidney. They're benign. Now you get into the threes where basically you have some enhanced septations
where the literature tells us about 60% of those can be malignant, but that malignancy is a very, very indolent malignancy that is very low risk. Again, make sure you partner with a good urologist who understands sort of the biology of kidney cancer, but usually those ones are very easy to follow. And same thing with Bosniak 4 cysts. They're really these cystic renal cell carcinomas that are very, very indolent. The, you know, if on the post hoc sort of data, when you resect them and you look, your kidney cancer specific mortality is zero for those. The only caveat for those, for the Bosniak 4s, is that sometimes necrotic lesions can mimic a Bosniak 4. And you just got to make sure that you're not sitting on an ugly necrotic tumor that is, you know, mimicking a Bosniak 4 lesion. And, you know, it's usually somebody with experience can tell those apart. The biopsy, you know, real quick on the biopsy, sort of, at least my take on the biopsy, there's a young patient that no matter, you know, even if it's an oncocytoma, no matter what the biopsy result is, it's unclear why you're doing it, because it's not going to change your management. You're going to treat that mass. And then there's the older patient where no matter what the biopsy shows you, you're going to watch that mass, right? Those are the kind of the extremes of the spectrum. But there is really a sweet spot for a biopsy in the middle where you're unsure what you're, you know, what you're going to do. If this was an oncocytoma, if this was a benign tumor, you would watch it. I think then, you know, biopsy is worthwhile. So you just have to make sure that if you're going to do a biopsy, that that information is actionable.
I asked the question because where do you put the hereditary syndromes of cancer?
I'm sorry, say that again.
That's
another layer of complexity. You know, a little bit different conversation depending on which, you know, what's up, you know, what type. I mean, there's some ones like HLRCC that are very aggressive where you can't watch. There's, you know, the Van Hoeven-Lindau that you watch them until they're more than 3 centimeters. So again, there's very nuanced management for those patients.
But, you know, for that, you should have a family history or a very young patient. A few of the risk factors for hereditary syndrome, you know, to give you at least some suspicion of that. If you don't have a suspicion, I'm not sure that I would think that every patient, in fact, the vast majority of patients have sporadic tumors, so I wouldn't think right away that someone has a hereditary issue. But in terms of, you were asking about the absolute indication for renal mass biopsy, and I was thinking maybe in 2018, the one might be if you suspect a metastatic renal cell carcinoma, which is very different than this group, because now our...
When you want to rule out metastatic carcinoma?
Well, if you think that someone has metastatic disease, because of our therapies and recent studies that suggest that perhaps upfront, frontline systemic therapy makes the most sense for some of these patients, I think that that might be one of the closer, I don't think there's any true absolute indication, but that's closer than most other ones, I think. But yeah. Otherwise, for small renal masses, you really have to look at the situation.
Yeah, the metastatic space is a whole different discussion. Obviously, it gets very complex there. I mean, I think the absolute indication, if you're worried about lymphoma or if you're worried about an abscess, you know, then it's worth biopsy. That's the absolute indication. Everything else is you kind of calibrate it depending on the patient and the clinical situation.
And when the patient, the incidental renal mass is discovered the same time with a lung mass, how do you rule out metastatic activity or a double synchronic primary?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times biopsying the lung mass is your go-to. I mean, if
do
if it's
big biopsy enough, of two sites.
Well, if you biopsy the lung mass and it's kidney, then you don't have to biopsy the kidney. Right. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I would also just add that, you know, I would completely agree with you on the need for communicating with the different specialty services and taking a multidisciplinary approach. I mean, I think when you have these cases, things get distilled down, but I think in each of these cases, there was direct conversation across the different services, and that's really the best way to go about it. Any other questions? All right, I think with that, we are finishing just on time. All right, thanks everybody.
Thank you everybody.